This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. A quick note before we get started. Today's conversation about equity in schools first aired last night on Facebook Live through a collaboration with our colleagues here at Indiana Public Broadcasting. It's been lightly edited to fit our radio format. Schools and school districts across the state are starting to reopen. The pandemic, meanwhile, seems far from over. There are guidelines from a number of places about how schools should handle this, but there are still a lot of ways they can choose to do it. We wanted to have a conversation about how those plans are being formed and implemented and how they might address lingering equity issues that have been heightened in a lot of ways by the pandemic. We're joined by three guests. Patricia Payne is the Director of Equity and Inclusion at Indianapolis Public Schools. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Walters is the principal at Beech Grove High School. Good evening, Elizabeth.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Andrea Tanner is the president of the Indiana Association of School Nurses. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you very much for having me, Matt.
Patricia, we'll start with you. Can you tell us about your role at IPS and what you do there?
I do a lot.
You've been there a while, too.
I am a director of the Racial Equity Office. And I have been with IPS now for 58 years, so I've seen a lot of changes over the years. Right now, we are in the midst of massive equity training, virtual, might I say, equity training, to make sure that all our teachers are ready and willing and have the belief system and the mindset to teach our very, very diverse student population. So that's it in a nutshell for now.
And so that's the racial equity mindset, commitment, and action policy that you're talking about?
Well, yes. The priority of our superintendent is a racial equity mindset. And on June the 25th, our school board unanimously approved a racial equity policy, 1619. Of course, that is when enslaved people were brought to America. And we also approved the Black Lives Matter resolution. Hmm.
Let's stick with the racial equity mindset, commitment, and action policy. What's the goal behind that policy?
The goal behind that policy is that we will no longer be able to predict who is going to be at the bottom, as we are now able to do. And in fact, our vision reads an IPS community where student outcomes cannot be predicted by race or ethnicity, as it is now possible to do due to systemic racism. And so that is why all of our teachers, in fact, everyone who touches the life of a child in IPS will now be part of a 2-day 9-to-5 racial equity training.
So what tangible impact will the policy have? How is it going to work to address these specific issues?
Well, first of all, what it has to address is racism. And so that's a big ticket to address racism, systemic racism. And that's all we've been hearing in the news. But IPS has been doing this long before the environment that we are now in happened. In 1979, we passed a policy for the teaching of Black history in the Indianapolis public schools, because at that time, our student population was Black and white. But when I looked at I was a second grade teacher at that time, by the way. But when I looked at the textbooks and the curricula, they did not reflect the students that I was teaching, nor did they reflect the society that I was trying to prepare students for. And so that is why we decided to start a movement then. And that movement has grown. First, it started with the resolution. Then we had an Office of Multicultural Education that I directed. We also have the Crispus Attucks Museum, which is located at the historic Crispus Attucks High School, which too, that was born out of racism, because our Ku Klux Klan school board did not want black and white students going to school together. So they built us our own school. And it was programmed to failure, but we took lemons and made lemonade. And so there were many, many amazing graduates, very, very successful graduates that came out of that school because their lives were touched by teachers who refused to accept mediocrity, teachers who made sure that educational excellence was the goal in that school. And when you hear the name of Crispus Attucks, so many people immediately think of Oscar Robertson, the basketball star, but Oscar would not have been on that court had not his grades been up to par. These teachers did not play. So, we have a legacy that Attucks has left that we want all of our students to meet.
Elizabeth Walters, you're the president of Beech Grove High School. Can you tell us about Beech Grove High School, where you're the principal, and I guess what's the school like?
Sure, happy to. And I just want to share a disclosure right now that I do have two dogs with me this evening who will probably join the show at some point. But yes, I am Liz Walters. I am the principal of Beech Grove High School, and I serve as past president for the Indiana Association of School Principals. Last year, when this conversation, and I think it's important to recognize this conversation didn't begin last year. I think this conversation evolved last year in very positive ways. But from a Beech Grove standpoint and the Indiana Association of School Principals, what we're really recognizing now is conversations that have happened in the past that may or may not have been organic or haphazard are now taking on really new meaning and taking on new actionable sort of outcomes. And so that's really exciting. The students to hear the students talk about that as a high school principal. That's why I, in part, love the high school age. But the truth is, I'm just really afraid of the elementary students because they bring their own sorts of challenges. But the high school students bring their voice and their conversation to the things that are happening around them in society. And what I'm feeling from them and hearing from them, especially from just our little world of Beech Grove, is really that those actionable outcomes. And that's exciting to get to participate and support them in having those conversations.
So what does your reopening plan look like right now? When are classes going to start?
Well,
we get a laugh. Okay.
So Beech Grove committed to their original calendar. We will start tomorrow, in fact. But in order for the district to prepare for reentry in really a safe, healthy, positive way for teachers, we are starting the year on 7 days of e-learning. So that was, of course, not directly related to COVID-19, in that sense, but of course, indirectly related. We want to be sure that our teachers are ready for the hybrid model that we plan to roll out grades 7 through 12. So we really thought that time was very important to prepare our teachers to make sure that they felt safe and comfortable before we allowed reentry and worried about the safety and comfort of our students. So we start tomorrow, K through 12, we will be on e-learning. And then our plan as of right now, and we definitely hope to stick to it, is August 10th, 7 through 12 will be on a hybrid model, and grades K through 6 will be back 100%. And we made that decision really specific to a lot of the guidelines that we're getting out of the CDC in Marion County. So our grades K through 6, and for those of you that may not know, Beech Grove services about 3,000 students. So we're a really tight-knit community in the southeast side of Indianapolis. And I have a lot of a lot of flexibility because of our size when compared to the township schools, for example, or IPS. But our K through six students really are cohorted sort of naturally. They are able to move as a cohort pretty naturally. So that's why we thought K through six, with those foundational skills and their ability to socially distance and keep students cohorted, they could return. And we hope to stick with that plan. But grades 7 through 12 are just sort of a different animal in that sense. We have students who move, both our middle school and high school are on block schedule. So we have students who move from class to class, 8 periods between 2 days. So it's somewhat a little bit more difficult for us to cohort in that sense. So to really pay attention to the safety and pay attention to the guidelines, we felt that a hybrid model would be appropriate for those levels. So half of our building, I should back up. So the 20% of our middle school and high school have self-selected into e-learning 100% of the time. So we did offer that at-home model to all of our students, and about 20% of them self-selected into that for various good reasons. So the 80% of our buildings that are remaining, they will be on a hybrid model where half of the building will come on Monday and Tuesday, and half of the building will come on Thursday and Friday. And then we will commit those Wednesdays for our teachers to really utilize that time in a virtual space to touch base with students who are at home 100% of the time, but also provide some of the extra attention and support to the students that they are only seeing now once a week in class.
There's a lot to consider, and it sounds like you're considering all of it. I mean, how did you develop the plan, I suppose?
Well, it was definitely organic. My superintendent and I joke a little bit. The plan was sort of developed in June when we started talking about all of the possibilities. But as none of us had a crystal ball at that moment, we sort of hoped and worked toward a re-entry that would open it for all of our students. But that plan resurfaced about probably, I'd say, 3-4 weeks ago when we really started looking at the trajectory of cases in Marion County and the conversations around Marion County. So it's been organic. It has definitely taken on a few shapes throughout those conversations. But one thing I thought was really important to begin with was to prepare our teachers for some control in this world of chaos that we're kind of living, just the constant flexibility that's needed. So we prepared for a blended model from an instructional standpoint very early on.
After a quick break, we'll have more from our conversation on medical and academic equity in schools. Since our show today was pre-taped, we can't get your questions and comments to our panel guests like usual. But let us know what you think and what you want us to cover next. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our conversation on medical and academic equity in schools, taken from a Facebook Live event we had last night through a collaboration with our colleagues here at Indiana Public Broadcasting. Andrea Tanner is the president of the Indiana Association of School Nurses. Can you tell us about your association, the Indiana Association of School Nurses? What do you do?
Sure. So the Indiana Association of School Nurses represents school nurses across our state. And our main goal is to make sure that school nurses are equipped and prepared to assist our schools in making sure students are healthy, safe, ready to learn, making sure our staff's healthy, safe, and ready to teach. So we are all about making sure students can be as successful as possible. And we know that academic health is a key indicator for their readiness to learn.
And so what are you hearing from other school nurses around the state right now as some schools reopen and others are preparing to reopen very soon?
So I'm hearing a lot of messages. Yes, there are certainly some of our school nurses who are back in school today with students. We've had some in our area who have been open for a little bit now, and we're all very busy. Whether we're in school or not in school, we are definitely busy. We're already starting to track cases of COVID-19 amongst our students and staff, already trying to identify when students and staff will be able to return to school, how long they need to be out, communicating with them about their close contacts, making sure that everyone who has been in close contact with a positive case is notified knows to quarantine for the appropriate amount of time. And in the midst of all of that, still preparing for all of those normal things that need to take place, like making sure we're prepared for students with type 1 diabetes and seizure disorders and severe food allergies. And nothing has changed about immunization requirements or vision screening requirements. So all of the normal school nurse things still need to happen in the midst of identifying students and assessing students who present with COVID symptoms.
Yeah, are there plans or things in place to address if those numbers spike, if you see cases spike, and if this becomes a really big problem? Is anyone talking about that? Is anyone really concerned about that being a possibility?
Absolutely. I think that is definitely a valid concern for a lot of our school districts. I think every school district in our state has a little bit different plan as to how we're going to handle that. And a lot of that is guided by our local health department. Our county health officer really calls a lot of the shots in how schools are handling those situations. What is our comfort level, our threshold with when we need to say, too much is too much, we need to back off and switch to virtual learning if we are in person right now?
What do you think about when you think about equity from the perspective of a school nurse?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think about both academic and health equity when I hear the word equity. And those two, as a school nurse, we see those two going hand in hand so closely. There's even a research team now that's identified that the number of times a student visits the health office can be a predictor of how well they're going to perform on standardized tests because their health and their academic performance are so closely intertwined. There's evidence to support that for students who are not able to proficiently read by the third grade are 4 times less likely to graduate. For our students who live in poverty, they're 13 times less likely to graduate. And if they don't graduate, that may knock 6 to 9 years off of their life expectancy because it affects their life so much, their health so much. So the two go hand in hand for me as a school nurse. From my perspective as a school nurse, what I fear I will see as we return to school in a couple of weeks is that that COVID will shine a light on a lot of inequities that have always been there, but it's going to be much more evident now. We're going to see students whose families may not be able to leave work to come and pick them up when they're showing signs of COVID and they need to go see a healthcare provider. They may not have a healthcare provider. They may not have health insurance to have access to a healthcare provider. They may not have transportation to get to a testing site. They may live closest to a testing site that requires you be inside of a vehicle to be able to receive your test, and they don't have a vehicle to be inside of, and they can't ride in public transportation to get there. So there's just a lot of barriers for some of our families. Even just something as simple as having reliable cell phone service and being able to receive a call from the school, or to be able to receive a text message from the contact tracing team to notify them that they've been a close contact of someone who's tested positive. So there's just a lot of potential barriers that are going to even further divide an already divided system for those who have access and those who don't have access.
We're talking about academic and medical equity in schools as they start to reopen. And we're talking with Patricia Payne, Director of Equity and Inclusion at Indianapolis Public Schools, Elizabeth Walters, Principal at Beech Grove High School, and Andrea Tanner, who we've just been speaking with, President of the Indiana Association of School Nurses. And Andrea Tanner, when I hear you say that, I wonder how it is you or other nurses handle, I guess, privacy when it comes to informing families, informing students. Like, you know, I'm sure that these students don't want all of their classmates to know that they don't have health insurance or that they, you know, that these issues come up. How do you navigate that?
Well, a lot of it is just one-on-one direct contact with each family to meet them where they are, meet their needs where they are. And it's a team approach too. With their permission, we can bring in a school resource officer to help sometimes with accessing the parent when we know that they're not going to be able to answer their phone. They could do a drive-by to let the family know that the student's in the health office needing them. It may be partnering with our school counselors, with therapists, with their social workers. So it's going to be a really really large village of people to help us navigate all of the different barriers we may encounter when it comes to medical inequity.
Patricia, are there details that we can talk about with the racial equity training at IPS? What'll it be like, I guess, when teachers do it?
Well, the first of all, let me say that IPS just decided today to go on full-time remote learning.
Yeah.
And we won't open until August the 17th. But to your question, the racial equity training is done by the Racial Equity Institute out of North Carolina. They've been with us since 2015, and we have already put over 3,000 of our staff members through the training. It is 2 days, and you have to go 2 consecutive days from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And we only talk about racism because we believe it's racism that's the bookends that hold all the other isms firmly in place. So we help people understand why people are poor. People don't want to be poor. They are poor because of laws and policies that were put in place intentionally long, long ago. For instance, the GI Bill, where soldiers would be over there fighting for our country, but when they would come home, no housing, no mortgages, except for the white soldiers. And that's just an example. Those laws and policies from long ago are no longer on the books, but the residue from them still is. And plus new laws and policies have been put in place. So our teachers, we help our teachers understand our students. We help our teachers go into their belief systems and try to rid those belief systems of the corrosion that is in there, that has been in there for a long time. And it's very, very difficult because those belief systems were formed by very sacred things, religion, parents, and all of those. So, but we teach teachers the truth. That's what we do, so that they can then also teach it to children. But mainly we do this so the low expectations can be expelled and high expectations can be in place, so that when they see skin color that is not like their own, because almost 90% of teachers in IPS are white, while about 75% of our students are students of color. And so the teachers have a directly different experience from our students. So that is all goes into place. And that's what that training is for. It's excellent training for anyone. It was excellent training for me. It is excellent training for people of color, not just for white teachers, you see, because we live in a racially constructed society. And so that is why it is very, very important. When I took the training, and of course, I've been in the training over 500 or 600 times because I'm there whenever the training is going on. But what it did for me, it kind of culminated all of my workshops and seminars that I've ever had and started to make sense of why Black and brown children are always at the bottom, why Black and brown families are always at the bottom when it comes to health, when it comes to housing, when it comes to finance, when it comes to whatever you think of. This insidious strand of racism is running through it and shaping the outcomes of everything.
Is there consensus in Indiana or maybe even across the country on what kind of racial equity training is most effective, or is just everybody trying to figure it out all at the same time?
Well, you know what? In the environment that we are in now, everybody's wanting racial equity training, but we've been doing it long before all of this all of the COVID, all of the inequities that COVID-19 has brought to light. That is because of racism. Mm. I mean, this is nothing new to us because those inequities have always been there, but COVID-19 has really shone the light on these inequities. So everybody now is wanting racial equity training. We think what we're doing and have been doing since 2015 is quite effective. But as long as people are doing something, that is what is important to me.
There's a lot of talk of these kinds of conversations being uncomfortable. Would you say that the training is uncomfortable in a lot of ways?
I hope it is, because you have to be uncomfortable to learn. That's part of the learning process. When you are uncomfortable, some of it makes me uncomfortable. When you are uncomfortable, that means you are on the journey. And what this is a journey. It's a never-ending journey. You are always learning. And the point that you get to when you think you have learned it all, that is when you are in trouble. We call this an equity movement. It's not a moment. It is a movement.
Elizabeth, let's talk a little bit more about your hybrid schedule. Have you gotten feedback from parents and students about this hybrid plan?
Yes, certainly. As is the case, that feedback is varied. We have a number of parents who would absolutely love to see their kids back in school full time, definitely see the benefits of that. And then we have a number of parents on the other end of the spectrum where they are gravely fearful of students returning to the building. So I think what the hybrid does and how we've provided the opportunity for parents and students to self-select into at-home learning or the hybrid, it really meets people in that middle ground to suggest that based on what we're able to do with PPE and our processes, with cohorting the students on Monday and Tuesday and separating that in the middle of the week, we're really able, oh, there he is. Yep. Hey, Oliver says hello.
Four-legged friends.
Yeah, we're really able to address some of those concerns. And parents and students that really struggle with that idea for 9 weeks can really just see how it works, ease into that, and see where we're at in the middle of October.
Okay, I have a follow up on that, but we'll wait on that. Andrea, what about the number of nurses at any given school? How much of a range is there? I guess I remember when I went to school, there was one nurse per school, and there are some schools with a few nurses, and then there are others where nurses travel to them, and there's nowhere near enough nurses to serve the population.
Sure. What a blessing to be in a school that had a school nurse all day, every day.
That's it was
definitely not the case in a lot of our schools in Indiana. So a lot of our school nurses are shared between multiple school buildings. Some of our nurses in the state cover 5,000 to 6,000 students all by themselves. In those situations, I have no idea how their schools are going to keep up with the number of students who will need assessed, the number of families that will need communicated with. A lot of us do rely on non-nurse personnel to assist us, but there's certain things you can't delegate to non-nurse personnel. I can't ask a health aide to perform a nursing assessment. Only a nurse can perform a nursing assessment. There are certain symptoms that we can ask about, we can look for, but at the end of the day, it's a registered nurse who's going to be able to handle that situation best and have the skill set to ask the right questions, to assess appropriately, and from a public health perspective, make the best decision for that student, that family, and that school. So a lot of schools will suffer when they don't have a full-time nurse all day, every day. And that's a lot of schools in our state.
Is there any kind of assistance or relief available for nurses at schools that might not have the resources they need? And if not, what could help?
Sure. So I think that for a lot of our school nurses, we will be relying heavily on community resources. I think for a lot of schools that don't have a full-time nurse, those students are going to be sent home a lot more often than if a child went to the health office in a school that had a school nurse. I think school nurses, and there's research to support this, that school nurses are much more comfortable sending a student back to the classroom than a non-nurse personnel or a health aide. So in those situations, a lot of those students and their families will just be referred to contact their healthcare provider and be assessed at the doctor's office or with their nurse practitioner or physician's assistant, and will not have a nurse there that could provide some of that assessment themselves. So I think we'll rely heavily on those outside sources. For some school districts, another opportunity may be telehealth. For some, this may be an excellent opportunity to use some CARES funding to connect with a telehealth resource where potentially there's a nurse practitioner or a pediatrician on the other end of the line who they can, in essence, FaceTime with, Google Meet, Zoom with, and be able to provide some sort of assessment that way as well. So that could be an avenue for some. This could be a great opportunity for some of our local hospitals, health departments. I know that no one has extra funding right now, but for those who are really community health minded, it might be a great opportunity for schools and healthcare systems to partner in looking at new ways of funding school nurses, because now more than ever would be a great time to consider a model where we have a full-time registered nurse in every school building in Indiana.
We'll be back after a quick break with our conversation on equity in schools. Since our show today was pre-taped, unfortunately, we can't get your questions and comments to our panel like usual, but we would always love to hear what you think and what you want us to cover next. You can send us a message online. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also listen to any one of our past shows on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our conversation on medical and academic equity in schools from a Facebook Live event hosted last night, made through a collaboration with our colleagues here at Indiana Public Broadcasting. Elizabeth Walters, I want to make sure that I come back to, how do you account for students who don't have the technology they need at home to get an education there?
So from an equity standpoint, we had that conversation a lot starting on March 18th. You know, many of us can remember we sent our students home on Thursday, not realizing that we would not see them the next day and not see them for the rest of the semester. And so that conversation in that sort of e-learning model was very, very centered around equity for providing the support for the students, providing the accommodations for students who we knew would really struggle with access to the e-learning model during quarantine specifically. So we spent a lot of time, Andrea mentioned the CARES money, looking at funding sources to make sure as we were preparing for all of the possibilities for the start of this school year, that we really attached support and access to the students that we knew would struggle with that. So students who would elect to stay home for very good reason needed to feel comfortable doing that without having to worry about an access issue. So our district committed through funding and through CARES Act to MiFi devices. We have a process in place to provide families those devices to take to the home to ensure that they feel comfortable staying home if they need to, but still have access to the educational supports that we would provide. We also have the opportunities, now more robust opportunities, to communicate with our students and parents to make sure that they know what the supports are in place at the school level, as well as outside of the school using companies and supports that might be available to them. So that access and equity issue was definitely a conversation since mid-March. And I think we've got a pretty good plan in place to address the needs of our staff and students.
It sounds like it. Do you think it's enough? Do you need more?
Yes. I'm never a proponent, for throwing money at a problem. But it's very clear in a situation like this, you know, outside of the school walls, just as Patricia mentioned, there is absolutely a divide between access and equity for students when asking them to feel comfortable staying at home. So more, I think, in a specific situation like this, It would be fantastic to consider, you know, citywide, you know, Wi-Fi access, to just very simply say, you know, if as a city we can commit to this, it removes a burden from a lot of conversation between schools and families that really isn't necessary, you know, in that sense. So yes, in this situation, I would certainly say if we could simply provide more access to students, we would be able to have really good conversation around educational services and instruction and assessment, and not worry about the equitable access situation.
Patricia Payne, the IPS board also passed a Black Lives Matter resolution recently. Can you talk about what that resolution says?
The Black Lives Matter resolution pretty much covers everything, including the board apologizing for the role that they played in systemic racism in schools, like having to build schools like Crispus Attucks that was born from racism. I can just, let me just read you one little part. It says, whereas Indianapolis Public Schools has participated in maintaining a system of racial inequality in the city of Indianapolis through its actions and inactions, policies and practices, budgets and priorities, advocacy and silence, and by too often privileging the prejudice of white parents over the well-being of Black students. And whereas, and it continues from there. It's about 6 pages long, and it's full of whereases that are very, very full of our school board being very brave and taking a stand. So I can do nothing but commend our superintendent, Alicia Johnson, who came to our district with a racial equity mindset as her priority. And our school board, who unanimously passed both the policy and the Black Lives Resolution. We will even be celebrating Juneteenth as a district holiday. To me, that is really something that is to be highly commended. It took a lot of guts to do what our board and our superintendent have done. And so in my 58 years of being with IPS, I must say, I've rarely seen a board and a superintendent that were so in sync on any one subject like they are on racial equity for our students and our entire school district. So I'm very, very proud of them and very happy to be a part of the Indianapolis Public Schools.
What do you say to some activists who criticize resolutions like this, despite the idea behind them being right? Their criticisms say that they're nothing more than a symbolic gesture in place of real change.
Yeah, you know, we hear that all the time, and maybe that has taken place before. But what we say is that these are not just words on a page. We've already started lifting these words off the page and putting them into action. All of our first year teachers, when they enter our school district, have to go through racial equity training. Now, I am speaking with principals at every principals meeting to make them feel more comfortable holding conversations about race and racism. That's not an easy thing to do. So we want to be sure that they feel comfortable doing that, because every school now has a school equity team and the district has a district equity team. So that we can be sure that after that 2-day training, they are still holding the work together within their schools, because we don't expect people to go out and change the world after 2 days of training, no matter how powerful it is. It has to be held together. So we make sure that our schools are disaggregating their data so that they can see who's always at the bottom and start questioning why this is happening, because it's been normalized and it shouldn't be normalized. We should be asking questions about this. When students come out of the womb as brilliant, but the longer they're in school, something happens, we need to be finding out why this is happening. And so we will be lifting these words off the page, and we've already started putting them into action. And I can do nothing but praise our superintendent and board for doing this.
Andrea Tanner, school nurses are going to be interacting with parents a lot, I imagine. What important things need to happen for that to go smoothly? Are there certain things you're worried about right now?
I think that bidirectional communication is key. I think transparency is key. I think the sooner that school systems can be clear with parents about what expectations are, when students will be sent home from school, if we're in-person learning, how long those students must stay out, what it's going to take for a student to come back to school. The earlier we can allow parents to be planning accordingly, the better this will go. And the schools are going to need a lot of help from parents this year. I mentioned making sure we've got good contact information, but that's going to be critical because it's very likely that at some point during the school year, we'll need to call to say your child has symptoms that require them to be picked up from school, or your child was a close contact of somebody else who tested positive, or it may be for some other reason. But more than likely, I'm going to need to call just about every parent at some point, I'm guessing. We also need parents to be honest with us. The success of schools being open in person really rests upon families being honest with us. When there is a positive test result, the school needs to know about that. If a student needs to be quarantined for 14 days because mom and dad or someone else at home or a close contact at church or in a sport or wherever, if they've been a close contact, the school needs to be notified so that we can work with that family to make sure over the next 14 days that student doesn't struggle academically because they're missing out on important schoolwork. So I think it's really critical that we're able to keep learning as continuous as possible, even if a student has to be home for 10 days because of symptoms, 14 days because of a quarantine, or because we have to shut the school down for a while because of a number of cases. We need to be prepared to do that. And parents being honest with us and us being transparent with them will make that go as smoothly as possible. And I want to make sure that school nurses can communicate with families whenever we have concerns, even if it's on e-learning days. I know a lot of people have questions about, well, what do school nurses do if students aren't even in the building? Well, I'll tell you, over the last 5 months, I don't think I've ever worked harder in my life. Just because we're not having students in a building doesn't mean that student health concerns aren't still first and foremost on our minds and still integral to their learning, even if that learning isn't happening inside of a school building. So we will still be working closely, whether students are in the building or they're learning at home.
Now, we're talking generally about this, but when we add the variable of urban schools versus rural schools, there are going to be differences there. How much of a difference is there when we talk about these issues?
So it can be quite a bit of a difference when you talk about rural versus urban. In the urban setting, typically there's going to be a testing site close by. There's typically going to be resources. There might be transportation. There might be things in place to help people get to the care that they need. But when we talk about more of our rural settings, they may have to drive an hour or more to even get to a testing site. For some of our families, I live in a border town where we're right across the river from Kentucky. So a lot of our families may end up receiving healthcare or going to get testing across the state lines. If that happens, we may get a delay in getting those test results back. Or even if it's just across the county line, they go to a different county to have that COVID test done. Getting those results back can take some time. I just talked to a family the other day where their 14-day quarantine was up before they ever got the test results back that said they were positive. So that delay can be integral, especially if someone doesn't understand the importance of quarantining, despite the fact you haven't even gotten your test results back. Because if they don't quarantine while they're waiting, that could have been many, many close contacts who came in contact with COVID during the time they were waiting for those positive test results.
Elizabeth Walters, we got a lot of questions from our audience worried about how safe it's going to be for students, but a number of them also noted just how important it is that kids get back to school because that's where they can really learn. I think there's a lot of skepticism out there about how much of a quality education a student can get from home. Do you share any of that concern?
Sure. I think it's very similar when you mentioned the differences between schools in terms of access, in terms of capacity and professional development with teachers. I think that preparation and that ability to provide a blended model or an e-learning model would vary from school to school very much. So essentially, from the standpoint of what you've heard from the audience, it's very similar, I think, to what I'm hearing from my families. People who value the education want to see students return, but very much want to see how that can be done in a safe way. So I'll reiterate just simply that choice for parents and students is very important. I think it's important that teachers and schools really put time and energy into the at-home learner experience to make sure that educational experience is equitable. I mean, that's hard to do. It's not going to be done overnight, but it's definitely something to pay attention to. And then I think the hybrid is very simply the best of both worlds. We can mitigate and we can put things in place that would hopefully lessen the exposure rates for students and do that with fidelity from a school standpoint and make it as safe as possible. That is putting a compromise in the sort of lesser of two evils to ensure that we bring kids back and provide those educational opportunities that are really, really important, especially at foundational levels, but also recognize that it's going to look a little different as we put protocols and PPE usage in place to make sure that we do mitigate exposure.
And there are plenty of different ways to handle the way schooling is done remotely. What separates good virtual learning from bad virtual learning?
It's a very good rabbit hole to jump down. there's quite a bit of factors to consider. I think when you think about good learning in general, whether it's virtual, whether it's in person, that really focuses on the student outcome, that focuses on what students are doing. And oftentimes what students are doing in conjunction with the feedback that the teacher can provide is what really creates those high level positive outcomes for students. So can that be done in a virtual environment? Absolutely, it's done very well. It has been done for quite some time. One thing that we talked about with our teachers the last 3 or 4 days, blended learning is not a new model. This is not a model that was born out of COVID-19. This is something that has been very successful in the past. So it's taking those critical attributes and really enacting what works well for students. And good instruction, no matter what it is concentrating on what the student outcome is in conjunction with the feedback that the teacher can provide. So that's the focus that we've attempted to create. As I said, very briefly in the last month, it will continue to evolve. But certainly what I would encourage all schools to consider, you know, learning is what student outcomes are. It's what we can measure in terms of student growth and student capacity. And so blended learning or an e-learning, if you have that focus in mind and your teachers are paying attention to what those student outcomes are, that can definitely be done in a virtual format.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests tonight. Elizabeth Walters, who we've just been speaking with, is the principal at Beech Grove High School. And a quick note to you before we go. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
And good luck going back to school. Thanks for your time. Patricia Payne is the Director of Equity and Inclusion at Indianapolis Public Schools. Thank you so much for your time and your insight.
Thank you.
Andrea Tanner is President of the Indiana Association of School Nurses. Thanks and good luck.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And to everyone listening, please stay in touch. You can share questions and let us know what topics are important to you by texting the word elections to 73224. That's what you do to join the Indiana 2022 way. And we'll hear from our colleagues. You will hear from our colleagues at Indiana Public Broadcasting every Thursday as they share reporting that was created from your responses. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow is our Friday Pitch-In, where we'll recap some of the biggest headlines of the week. I'm Matt Pelser. Thank you for listening. This is All In.